Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, our foreign correspondent, Bill Burke-White, will be with us speaking about Uganda and issues of peace and justice there. And he's also going to be giving us a report live from the Democratic primary in Pennsylvania. Right now, I'd like to welcome Nina Jablonski. She's a biological anthropologist, professor of anthropology at Pennsylvania State University, and author of Skin, a Natural History, published by the University of California Press. And she will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe in a lecture titled Skin Deep, Evolution of Human Skin and Skin Color, sponsored by the Leakey Foundation and the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, who knew that there could be a natural history of skin? It's such an interesting topic in the first place.
Well, you know, we all have skin. We all use it. We all love our skin, but we don't really think about it very much. And one of the things,
except ladies of a certain age, maybe.
But ladies of a certain age think about their wrinkles, they think about sun damage, but we all need to think about how our skin came to be. And I wrote the book that I did about skin because I realized that although dermatologists and doctors think about skin, ladies of a certain age think about skin, that we all needed to think about our skin and how it evolved, its particular properties, especially its skin color.
So let's talk about the three features of human skin that make it unique in the animal kingdom.
Well, human skin is remarkable for these three reasons. Firstly, it's mostly naked. Apart from a few patches of hair that we have on our heads and a few other parts of our body, we're functionally naked. And we're very sweaty. So that's the first thing, that we're basically naked and extremely sweaty, and the sweat helps to keep us cool when we're exerting ourselves.
Now, what is the evolutionary adaptiveness of having so much less hair than our chimp and ape cousins?
Well, basically it comes down to the fact that being without hair helps you lose heat through sweating more effectively. And so as we lost our hair, we increased the number of sweat glands on the surface of our skin, and that made us very much better at cooling our bodies during times of exertion or when the environment's really hot. So having less hair in a hot place, especially if you're really active, is very important.
Why is the male half of the species so much hairier than the female?
Well, in some populations of humans, that is true. But in many populations, both sexes are equally hairless. So we generally associate hairiness with European men, or men of European ancestry.
Who are closer to their chimp relatives?
That may be your opinion.
But
we don't really know why European males have so much hair, but the rule for most of the species is functional hairlessness in both sexes.
Interesting. So you start off the book talking about the fact that the skin is an organ, which is something I remember learning in biology class way back when, but most people don't think of it that way.
Well, the skin is an organ because it does so much stuff. It has multiple layers in it, and in these layers, it has different kinds of glands. It has sweat glands. It has cells from the immune system. It has pigment-producing cells. It has hair follicles. I mean, it's this complex bunch of different kinds of biological tissues all working together. And what the skin does is basically help maintain our body's homeostasis. It helps keep us cool. It protects us from outside influences like excess amounts of water or chemicals or bacteria. I mean, it's this incredibly versatile covering. Also, it comes in a range of colors, and that's the second unique aspect of skin that I wanted to point out, because this natural range of colors isn't at all arbitrary. It evolved in the course of our species evolution, and that's one of the most exciting things about us, is that we come in this range of colors from almost near ebony, very, very dark brown, to near ivory, very, very pale, almost white. And those colors are very much related to the levels of ultraviolet radiation that our ancestors experienced.
And the third thing is that we humans decorate ourselves.
Yes, we love to do all sorts of things to our skin to make statements about who we are. You know, during your own lifetime and during the lifetimes of your parents, the styles of decoration have changed. We've gone from having different kinds of cosmetics to sort of extreme tattoos, to body paints, to different kinds of piercings. And through the ages, people have come to express themselves in various ways through the decorations they place upon their skin. Some of them are just temporary, some of them are permanent, but they say a lot about us in terms of what we aspire to be, the groups that we affiliate ourselves with, and how we want people to view us.
We're talking to Nina Jablonski. Let's go back to the question of skin color. How did the variation in skin color evolve, and what color were the first tribes of human beings running around Africa?
Well,
And how do we even know? Because, I mean, the fossil record isn't going to contain that.
That's right. We make a lot of the inferences about the evolution of skin by looking at comparative anatomical evidence as well as molecular and genetic evidence. So we don't have actually fossilized skin in different colors. We use indirect kinds of evidence to make these inferences. But one of the things that we know for certain is that humans evolved in the tropics under very high ultraviolet radiation conditions. And so they really needed to protect their skin against the harmful effects of ultraviolet radiation. Now, in nature, we have this marvelous set of compounds called melanins, which are very stable, natural pigments. And the most common type of melanin is extremely dark. And that pigment is used by a variety of different animals and to great advantage, because melanin absorbs and scatters ultraviolet radiation. And so in many animals who have evolved in the tropics or in under other high UV regimes, they've evolved a lot of melanin in their skin or their protective coverings. And so what did humans do in the course of their evolution? Just the same thing. We evolved new genetic variations that led to us having high levels of melanin in the skin of our equatorial ancestors.
So the more melanin, the darker you are.
The more melanin, the darker you are, the better you're prepared against the deleterious effects of high UV in the sunlight. All of our ancestors for our lineage of modern humans were darkly pigmented. They lived in the tropics, and they then dispersed outside of the tropics to other parts of the world in the last 130,000 or so years. And that's where different colors of skin, different shades of skin evolved, because as soon as you move outside of the tropics and UV isn't so intense, then you have to actually lose pigment in the skin.
Why?
Because your skin is a really complex organ, as we mentioned. And one of the things that it does is it actually serves as a vitamin D factory. You produce vitamin D in your skin. Now, if you live at the equator and you've got dark skin, you can produce a lot of vitamin D just because the intensity of the UV is so high. UV radiation interacts with the skin to produce vitamin D. But if you live outside of tropical areas, the wavelengths of ultraviolet radiation that actually produce vitamin D are much fewer. They form a lesser percentage of the sunshine. And so it's harder for people who live even at the latitude of Santa Fe, or certainly at the latitude of New York City or Nova Scotia, to produce vitamin D in their skin from the level of ultraviolet that they get in the sun. So the long and short of it is, people actually had to become lighter as they moved and lived for long periods of time outside of tropical latitudes.
So Northern Europeans are going to be lighter than Southern Europeans, who are going to be lighter than people from the tropics.
That's right. And the lightness of the skin facilitates the penetration of ultraviolet radiation in the skin and the production of vitamin D.
So if you are a black person and you move to Sweden, you better take vitamin D supplements.
That's right. And this is one of the things that we've realized, is that in the last 500 years, and especially just in the last 100 years, people have moved around dramatically with great rapidity, so that folks from equatorial Africa can now live in Sweden. People from Sweden can go live in equatorial Africa. And they both have to take into account the fact that their skin isn't inherently well adapted to those environments.
And so they have to bring sunscreen or vitamins. And do most people know this?
No. I mean, we, as light-skinned people, many of us know about the problems of being in the sun, because so many doctors tell us about the risk of skin cancer. But we don't know about so many of the other damaging effects of excess amounts of sun. This can affect people with lightly pigmented skin, because you can get a lot more than just skin cancer from too much sun. But one of the great and poorly recognized problems of darkly pigmented people is that when they do move to a northerly place, or if they simply have a desk job and sit inside all the time, that they won't get enough sun to make vitamin D. And so they need to take vitamin supplements so that they make sure that their vitamin D concentrations are up to par.
We're talking to Nina Jablonski. So let's move on to the whole topic of decoration. What are the various ways that people decorate their skin, and what are their reasons for doing it?
Well, people decorate their skin for a variety of reasons. And some people prefer to only wear, you know, the lightest amount of temporary decoration. They might put body paint on for a particular ceremony. They might put a little extra blusher on their skin to look a little, what they would call, healthier or fresher at various times of the day. But other people put permanent marks on their skin, usually for more serious reasons. So we see both temporary and permanent kinds of body markings, and generally the temporary ones are for single occasions or for making people look good for a short period of time, let's say for an initiation ritual, or so that you look good in a particular photograph. But if you decide to do something permanent, you're making a much different kind of statement. People who have pierced ears, or multiple facial piercings or body piercings, or people who undertake tattooing, a little tattoo or multiple tattoos, they're making a real statement about how they want the world to see them, about the group that they associate with. Or in many cases, when people get a large series of tattoos, they're really trying to tell people in a very immediate way, these things that I've put on my skin are important to me. These pictures relate to my history, to my heritage, to my life, and I want you to know them. So people decorate themselves for a wide variety of reasons, and it's absolutely fascinating.
Well, there's one group that you told me that you wrote about that the women get tattoos all over their faces so that the men of other places don't take their women away.
Yes, and there are some groups, especially in East and Southeast Asia, in which women receive these facial tattoos at the time they go through puberty so that they become marked as members of that group. Men within their group think that these tattoos, these beautiful geometric designs on their faces, are very beautiful. But men outside of their group think that they're ugly and
right,
that they look like they have like a crossword puzzle on their face. So this is something that helps to maintain the women within their group so that they don't leave.
Often wondered, there was a period, I don't know whether it was 10 or 15 years ago, where a lot of young people, Americans, started getting tattoos in numbers that their corresponding people, 10, 20 years earlier had not gotten at all. And I wondered whether you know, getting something that permanent when you're that young was kind of a statement that you thought, well, the world is going to end anyway. Who cares if something's permanent? Because our lives our days are numbered anyhow.
I think that's certainly part of it. And I also think that it had to do with the fact that lots of celebrities were getting tattoos, and young people very much want to be accepted by their peer group. And so if having a tattoo like a particular celebrity helps you become more accepted in your group, then you're going to get it. And it doesn't matter if your parents say, or if your some of your friends say, well, you know, you might not like that in 5 years. Who cares? You know, you want to get it now because you want to look cool. And so I think there's a big element of sort of looking cool almost at any cost.
You have a chapter in the book on touch and the importance of skin touching skin, you know, one person's skin touching another person's skin. And I wondered, what is the electrochemical phenomenon that's going on with touch?
Well, in our skin, we not only have all of these different glands that I was telling you about, but we also have a variety of different sensory receptors. They're extremely good at detecting temperature and various depths of touch, light touch, deep touch. And basically what goes on is when we touch something, those touch receptors send particular kinds of signals back to the brain indicating the kind of touch that's going on. So these are special kinds of neurons, special kinds of nerve cells that conduct particular kinds of information. And we are endowed as primates with a lot of these specialized touch receptors, specifically on our hands and our faces. So the density of these is very high, and we can discriminate tremendous amounts of detail about any surface that we're touching or about another person from these different receptors in our fingers and in a face.
And so what is the adaptive purpose of having so much in your fingers and your face? I mean, is it just knowing your environment in terms of the hands, and then being careful of any kind of invasion of your body?
That's certainly part of it, but it's also being able to tell a lot about the texture of food that you might eat. Is this fruit really good to eat? You can discriminate very fine levels of ripeness just by touching a piece of fruit. You can also touch a person and immediately feel if they're running a temperature, if they're cold and clammy. We get a huge amount of information about other humans just from touching them. So basically, they're, in addition to our eyes, our fingers are these huge information gathering instruments about our environment.
Now, you talk about societies that are I can't remember what you call it, some societies are full of people who touch each other a lot, and then others don't. And
yes.
Some people carry their babies and other than put them in strollers.
Yes.
And so on. What's the difference between those two?
Well, I like to talk about touch averse and touchy kinds of societies.
Right.
And what's interesting is that now in the United States, you have a real battleground between touch-averse and touchy people. In most of the workplaces in which we operate, we are not allowed to touch one another. And yet, inherently, we want to. We want to be able to touch people, and not necessarily in sort of lascivious ways or inappropriate ways. We want to be able to comfort one another or touch one another at natural times. So the United States, in the last 20 years, has become a legislated touch-averse society outside of the home. And that's quite unfortunate, because we benefit physically from touch. We evolved to touch one another. And when societies, either through legislation or through practice, when people stop touching one another, it actually leads to much higher levels of anxiety and stress, because touching helps to relieve anxiety and relieve long-term stress. It's quite remarkable in its property. So that's the United States. But there are countries that are very touchy. If you go to Europe, for instance, if you go to a typical Italian family gathering. My family background is half Italian, so when I go to an Italian family gathering or go to Italy, people are constantly touching and hugging one another. It's a normal part of human commerce, and they feel that it's an essential part of the family bond and bond with friends. If you go to England, it's one of the more touch-averse places, as are parts of Germany. There are various populations that are exceptions, but these countries are very touch-averse, and touch is formalized by just a handshake or very, very formal pecks on the cheek, and big hugs and, you know, lots of arm holding and so forth are really not part of normal human commerce.
Well, and I've traveled to places where it is absolutely normal for a 10 or 12 year old child to sleep in the bed with their parents or their cousins or even a guest. You know, I'm lying in bed and the 10 year old crawls in, and that's just considered the way it is. Partly because there's not enough beds, but partly because I think it makes a huge difference in how people feel in their bodies and how they walk around in their lives.
It's something that in the United States, again, we have come to eschew, this idea of bringing kids up in close physical proximity to their parents, although we're taught that we should keep infants very close to our bodies because that's important. As soon as an infant gets to be sort of 9 or 12 months old, we're told, oh, it's good for them to, you know, start sleeping in their own crib, and then they have their own room, and they should be physically separated so that they become more independent and tough. And this is really more American culture. It is not human nature. Our nature is to maintain close physical proximity throughout our lives. And although I have no special retrospectroscope to see the past, I can infer from the activities of our primate relatives and also from many indigenous groups in the world that people stay in close contact with one another throughout their life. Kids do tend to sleep with their parents for long periods of time, you know, into their early teens, even before they become mature adults themselves. And so we have evolved this touching, this proximity, and this helps to relieve stress in many social situations because touching does lower levels of stress hormones in the body. So the kind of behavior that we see in sort of normal American houses is quite abnormal for our species, even though we consider it to be, you know, really the only way to operate.
Nina Jablonski is a biological anthropologist. There's much more to talk about, but unfortunately it's time to go. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And her book is called Skin, A Natural History, published by the University of California Press. And she'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center here in Santa Fe. And the lecture is titled Skin Deep, The Evolution of Human Skin and Skin Color, sponsored by the Leakey Foundation and the School for Advanced Research. We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. Bill Burke White is up next. I'd like now to welcome Bill Burke White. He's a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our foreign correspondent. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Bill.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be with you, as always.
And you are not only going to talk to us about foreign affairs today, but you're going to tell us a little bit about what's happening in Pennsylvania. You're there live at the Democratic primary. You're at one of the polling places.
I am, in fact, at one of the polling places this morning. I am in the 10th Ward in North Philadelphia, which is a largely African-American community, not too far from the center of Philadelphia. It is primarily an area where Barack Obama is expected to do extremely well, and I can report to you that voting has been going very smoothly, at least in this ward this morning, with hundreds of voters turning up, but lines aren't too long, and it looks like a smooth morning, at least in this part of town. There's expectations of some lines and congestion this evening in the after-work rush. Given the unprecedented number of people who have registered to vote, we are expecting a sort of onslaught of voters this evening. But at the moment, things are flowing quite smoothly.
So you have recently come back from Uganda. The subject of our conversation today is the country of Uganda, and you were actually commissioned to write a report for the government of Uganda about the peace and justice process there. How did you get involved with that?
Well, about 2 years ago, I was working for the International Criminal Court in The Hague in the Netherlands, which is prosecuting the leaders of the rebel movement, the Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda. And I think 2 years ago, you and I may have actually talked about my time at the International Criminal Court.
Right.
But after my work there, I was asked by the government of Uganda to assist them as they were thinking about the role of justice and accountability in Uganda. And then I went down to Uganda in August of 2006. And then last August was commissioned by the Ugandan ambassador to the Netherlands, which is where the International Criminal Court sits, to produce a report for them on the implementation of a series of agreements that they have reached with the rebels about justice and accountability. And in fact, next early in May, we will present to both the Ugandan government and the U.S. Department of State versions of this report that really looks at both the relationship between domestic trials that governments might hold after a conflict and trials before the International Criminal Court, and then also looks at the wider range of things that a country needs to do to recover from 20 years of civil war and ethnic conflict. So we're very excited that this will be going off to the government and hopefully reinvigorating a peace process that has been looking very promising over the last year or so, but hasn't been able to reach a final solution, which was supposed to lead to a signing of a peace deal at the end of last week, and did not. So it's a time to try to reinvigorate that process and see if we can move closer to both peace and justice in a very troubled part of Africa.
Tell us what the conflict in Uganda over the last 20 years has been about in the first place.
Yeah, briefly, this has been a sort of 20-year civil war that we could actually trace back even earlier to British rule, where the British colonial rulers tended to favor the southern part of the country. And then the next leader after that of any consequence was Idi Amin, the sort of horrible dictator from Uganda that many of you may have heard of. And he was from the northern part of the country and tended to support the interests of the north over those of the south. And when he fell from power, Yoweri Museveni became the new president, and he was from the south and tended to support the south over the north. And after Museveni came to power, a guy named Joseph Kony started a kind of rebel movement based in the north, pushing for kind of the rights and interests of those in the northern part of the country. But Kony was not completely rational or perhaps even sane, and he believed that he heard the word directly from God as to what he was supposed to do, and began a very violent campaign in which, sadly, the victims were largely the northern population that he was supposedly trying to assist, because the way he funded and ran his campaign over the past 20 years was essentially to go into villages in the north and kidnap boys to turn them into child soldiers to fight alongside him, and kidnap girls and young women to turn into forced wives. So you had a kind of perhaps somewhat legitimate initial cause, the sort of neglect of the north, but it ended up turning into a violent campaign in which the victims were those northern Ugandans themselves.
And so how did the conflict come to a head or come to a resolution? I mean, it's not going on in the same way that it was.
Well, it's not going on as badly as it was for quite some time, but that said, the leaders of the Lord's Resistance Army are still at large. A couple things have happened. The first and perhaps most important thing was that in 2005, the president of Uganda, who had been unable to reach a deal with these rebels or to catch them, called in the International Criminal Court and invited the International Criminal Court to open an investigation of this rebel group. And then later in 2005, the International Criminal Court indicted these rebels. And that has made it much more difficult for them to operate, made it much more costly for them to get weapons because other states no longer wanted to provide support to indicted warlords. So part of it was the role of the International Criminal Court. Another part has been a peace between the north and the south in Sudan. Of course, there still is the conflict in Darfur in the other part of Sudan. But this peace between the north and south has made it much harder for the rebels to kind of hide across the border and sneak back into Uganda to commit acts of violence. And so for the last 2 years, the Lord's Resistance Army has essentially been hiding in a national park in the eastern part of the Congo, another one of the neighboring states in that difficult part of Africa. And hiding there, they have been unable to continue inflicting violence in northern Uganda. But the fact that they're still at large and there hasn't been a peace deal means that hundreds of thousands of Ugandans are still living in internally displaced persons camps and that life has not been able to return to normal in any sense of the word in northern Uganda.
One of the things that we have discussed before on this program and that is very much an issue here is the tension between peace and justice. On the one hand, there is the need to bring people to justice who've done absolutely horrible things. On the other hand, there are calls for amnesty so that people can get on with the process of peace and living in peace. Tell us more specifically what's going on there, how that plays out in Uganda.
Well, it's a really tough question because the problem is essentially this. The Ugandan government signed up to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court that requires that the perpetrators of massive crimes face justice. Yet, and that process actually has probably made the whole peace negotiation easier in a sense because it created a threat to the Lord's Resistance Army that if they didn't come in from the jungle and negotiate a peace, they would be sent off to The Hague and prosecuted. The problem now in the peace talks is this. The Lord's Resistance Army says, we will come in from the jungle, we will sign a peace accord, we will end the war, but only if you take away the arrest warrants from the International Criminal Court. And so Uganda finds itself at a kind of impasse. On one hand, it's obligated to the international community to prosecute these individuals or to send them off to The Hague to face prosecution. And it's probably even owes it to its own people to make sure that the perpetrators of such horrific crimes face justice. But if it wants to end the conflict and bring about an end to 20 years of civil war, it may require giving these horrible leaders amnesty and failing to fulfill an international obligation to surrender the leaders of the Lord's Resistance Army to the International Criminal Court to face prosecution. So Uganda is in a bind where on one side it has a duty to provide justice, and on the other side, bringing about peace may require sacrificing that very justice. And so where we are at the moment in the negotiations between the Ugandan government and the Lord's Resistance Army is trying to find a solution to what is essentially a deadlock between peace and justice in these negotiations.
And that falls on your shoulders, Bill Burke-White. I mean, you brought a team of law students whom you were teaching at the University of Pennsylvania to go and try to address the situation. It seems like a tension with, I mean, what's the resolution?
Well, there is no perfect resolution. And what you usually have in these debates are very categorical claims in which some people will say justice is the most important value and we have to provide justice even if it means that the war continues. And in fact, that has been the position of the International Criminal Court. The prosecutor of the court made a bold statement a few months ago in which he said essentially that the court's job was to pursue justice and that he would not bend or flex in any way based on the political situation on the ground. On the other side of this debate, you tend to have people who say, you know, justice is all well and good, but what matters most is peace. And even many of the northern Ugandans you speak to say that the most important value for them is peace and ending the war and bringing their lives back to some version of normalcy. So we have spent the past year looking hard at this question and working with the Ugandans and with the International Criminal Court have pushed the Ugandans, hopefully, in a direction that might allow you to achieve both peace and justice. And that justice may not look exactly like the justice that the International Criminal Court has in mind, but to understand the solution that we're advocating requires a little bit of background on the International Criminal Court itself and what states agreed to in 1998 when they created this new court. In the Rome Statute that established the court, states agreed, first of all, that there was an obligation to provide justice for serious and systematic international crimes, things like rape and murder conducted as part of a widespread attack on a civilian population. But the International Criminal Court itself was established to have what lawyers would call complementary jurisdiction. And what that means is that national governments are supposed to have the first obligation to prosecute international crimes themselves, and that the International Criminal Court should only step in when national governments are unable or unwilling to prosecute these crimes themselves. If you think about the number of horrific crimes around the world that happen every year, there's no way that one relatively small court in the Netherlands could provide justice for all those crimes. So the court was created to give national governments the kind of first mover advantage. Let them act first, and then the international court only steps in where national governments don't prosecute. And when Uganda called up the court back in 2005, they said to the court, hey, look, we cannot prosecute these people because they're hiding in a national park in the Congo, and we can't get our hands on them. So even if we wanted to prosecute them, we can't. And what seems to have happened now in the negotiations, and our recommendations seek to implement, is a recognition that the Ugandan government, despite having called in the International Criminal Court, still has the right to prosecute these individuals first. And so what the current negotiations are calling for is the creation of a special court in Uganda that would prosecute these individuals. And if the special court in Uganda does so, the International Criminal Court does not have the right to come in and try to prosecute these rebels themselves. What's significant about this is that the rebels, particularly their leader, Joseph Kony, has said that he might well be willing to submit to prosecution in Uganda, but certainly is not willing to submit to prosecution in the International Criminal Court. Now, that might seem a little strange because, look, why would you rather be prosecuted by your enemy, the president of Uganda, than in a neutral court in The Hague? And there's really two reasons, I think, why Kony might prefer this. The first is that the negotiations are calling for alternative sentences, sentences less than, for example, murder that would be called for under the Ugandan Penal Code. And secondly, I think Kony has a hope that perhaps a few years down the line, either President Museveni of Uganda would soften his position and perhaps pardon the rebels, or that there might be a change in power in Uganda, and as part of that power change, they might get pardoned. So Kony, I think, sees a domestic prosecution as more acceptable to him because he might end up with a lesser sentence or the chance of early release, which would not be available to him if he were prosecuted by the International Criminal Court. So what all this means is that we're suggesting to the Ugandan government that they create a special court domestically, that they accept some version of alternative sentences for the rebels, but not sentences that are so limited or so short or so weak that they would not be seen by either the Ugandan people or the International Criminal Court as a genuine effort to bring these warlords to justice. And if the Ugandans are willing to create this court and provide significant, even if alternative, sentences, there may be a way to avoid this kind of paradox between peace and justice, there would be some compromise on justice. It wouldn't look like justice in The Hague, and it might not have as long a prison term, but it would still be meaningful justice, but perhaps justice that even the indicted rebels would be willing to accept, and justice domestically that would be strong enough to keep the International Criminal Court at bay and lead to a resolution that could achieve both peace and justice.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. Now, you're talking about setting up a special court for this. How functional is the Ugandan judiciary, and how would that court be set up given the judiciary that they have?
Well, the Ugandan judiciary is actually surprisingly good, given that it's a judiciary in a relatively troubled country in Africa. It inherited its legal system from the United Kingdom. It has a functioning Supreme Court and regional courts. And the current proposals suggest that there is a special division of the High Court, of the Supreme Court, created to try a relatively small number of these rebels. There were only five people indicted by the International Criminal Court, and only a few hundred others that are still at large. And so the number of trials would not be as many as you might have had in, say, Rwanda, where hundreds of thousands of people were engaged in the crimes. So there's reason to believe that the Ugandan judiciary can do this. Yes, they'll need some international help, perhaps some aid donations and so forth. But the Ugandan judiciary can do this as long as we can get a deal with the rebels that they submit themselves to Ugandan jurisdiction and come in from the jungle.
I have to just... as an aside, say that this is quite an education for your students. I mean, you know, people go to college, they apply to law school, they get into the University of Pennsylvania, and suddenly they're in Uganda writing documents that are incredibly important.
Well, some of your listeners may have watched a movie called The Paper Chase a long time ago, which is sort of your classic vision of what a law school curriculum is about. This is the idea that the students read the cases and come sit in the assigned seats, and the professor walks in and turns to one of them and says, "Mr. So-and-so, tell me the facts of this case," and then the professor glares at them while the student feels ashamed because he or she doesn't have the answers. Part of what we're trying to do here is say that legal education need not be that classical model. And true enough, we took a dozen students down to to Uganda. We had more than 50 interviews, ranging from the Attorney General of the country to representatives of the rebel group to child mothers in internally displaced persons camps, and then to come back from that and write a report for the government that provides meaningful policy advice is truly an extraordinary opportunity to learn, but also one that tries to integrate the education process with real life and real problems. And this has been going on in law schools, particularly on the local level, with things like tenant advocacy clinics. But what's exciting about this project is it takes it to a whole new level, where the recipient of the advice is the government of Uganda and the United States Department of State. As the professor doing this, I have been extraordinarily fortunate to be able to watch and learn from my students as their worlds were turned upside down. They went to Uganda after lots of research here with one set of ideas and conceptions of what justice meant and what peace meant and what Uganda was like, and I watched as their world was just totally flipped upside down. And that, I believe, is the true value of a modern legal education.
What do you mean flipped upside down? Like, what did they see that surprised them?
I think many of the students went in saying, you know, justice is the most important thing here. They're law students, after all. They believe in the law and in justice and in courts and in the ability of the law to build a kind of stable future. And when they talked to ordinary Ugandans and they saw the conditions on the ground, I think they saw two things. First of all, that justice is a deeply conditional concept, and that to be a lawyer in America may mean one thing, but if you're thinking about the way law works in a developing country coming out of civil war, you have to rethink those notions and probably have much more flexibility in how you see and how you envision the law working. I think the other thing that was transformed in many of their minds is this idea that trials were sufficient, that if you put these people in jail, you move beyond the conflict. And one of the things they really saw was that there were huge problems in northern Uganda that needed to be addressed, ranging from reparations to an amnesty process to a truth commission, and that all of those other elements had to be part of whatever the solution we suggested for the Ugandan government ultimately would be.
And as you've talked about, a big part of the process is a healing process, a mass collective healing process for the country. Where does your work fit in and help to foster that?
So as I was saying, you know, a trial may be a part of healing, but there's a number of things that need to get done. One of them is sort of community-level healing, right? It's fine to prosecute some people in the high court, but at the end of the day, the question is, can you live with the person who lives in the hut next to you in your village? And so we make a series of recommendations about that process of healing. Many of these countries and communities had local justice processes, often referred to as traditional justice. And traditional justice was a way that a tribe might have a healing with another tribe, or people within a tribe have some sort of healing process. And many people, in particularly in the West, have said, oh, fine, just use traditional justice and everyone will be happy and healed. But as we investigated traditional justice in Uganda, we saw that it was an important part of Ugandan culture, but also a deeply troubled part. Troubled in part because women are largely excluded from the processes, and women are often the most serious victims of the kinds of crimes we're dealing with. And also troubled because every community in Uganda had its own kind of process, and you couldn't impose a sort of national traditional justice and healing. So we have suggested that the government encourage very local levels of traditional healing ceremonies, which can include bending of spears or drinking of the juice of a bitter gourd together, but that the government also provide a fund that would fund these processes only where each local community does some things to modernize their traditional justice processes. For example, allowing women to participate in the ceremonies, allowing a more open process, and making sure that one is both respecting the local history and culture, but not excluding women victims from the healing process. So we hope that the use of a fund in this way would give local communities an incentive to modernize their traditional justice processes, but not feel like they're at the sort of fiat of a national government that doesn't understand who they are, telling them what to do. So one piece of this is traditional justice, and then there's other elements that we could talk about, such as reparations and an amnesty commission that we've also recommended.
Well, we've got just about a minute left. Reparations are something that, you know, I would think would be very hard in a poor country.
It's really hard. You know, you have hundreds of thousands of victims of crimes and a government that doesn't have the resources to build them a house or hand them a check. So we have suggested a community-based reparations process where the government actually comes into communities and apologizes for its failure to protect, you know, communities in northern Uganda from horrific crimes, and then does things on a community level rather than an individual level, like building a new school or creating a community center. But that what's critical about these reparations is the government needs to apologize for its failure to protect its own people from a horrific set of crimes that it may not have committed, but that it didn't stop.
So it's almost time to go, but what happens next? You present this report. You're going to go to Uganda again to present the report?
We're actually going to present the report via a video uplink to the Ugandan government, and hopefully it will provide some reinvigoration for the you know, not failed, but potentially failing peace negotiations. And then the real question is whether the government of Uganda is willing to take some of the hard steps that they need to, not just from our recommendations, but from a range of other sources as well, and whether the international community is willing to come in and help, and the International Criminal Court is willing to accept justice that might be a little less than they might hope, but would be compatible with a broader peace settlement. And so we'll be presenting these recommendations, and then all eyes will be on Uganda to see whether the process can move forward. It'll be a hard and long process. We don't expect immediate change because of our report, but hopefully it will be part of a broader process leading to peace and justice in northern Uganda.
Bill Burke-White is Professor of International Law at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us today on KSFR.
It's a pleasure to be with you, and good morning to all in Santa Fe. Take care.
You too. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Hasta la vista. Bye.